The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey y'all, this is Lisa Adkins on Agile Uprising.
Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm James Gifford, and we're on location at Mile High Agile's
Mile High Agile Conference.
It's the Mile High Agile Conference. You know, I've given this introduction now like 10 times.
10th time, 11th time's the charm.
Yeah, you know.
Maybe.
I screw it up. But so, with me I have Colleen.
Hey, everybody.
And we have David Bernstein.
Yes.
The amazing author of Beyond Legacy Code.
Oh, and, thank you.
And it's been about 3 years since we've had David on the cast, and you know we've found him here at the event, and we tackled him and asked him to come on the show. So
very willingly, yes.
So we, you know, Colleen's done a couple different talks on Kanban this week, and I was talking about different metrics and how quality is more about software craftsmanship than it is about bugs and defects. And you know, as we kind of look at these topics, we wanted to kind of get David's perspective from, you know, Colleen and I are talking about cycle time and helping teams work more efficiently, and talking more about the practices and things like that to drive it. But the thing that everybody freaking forgets about are all the strong technical practices that came out of the XP movement, the clean coding movement, and all these other movements. And David's book, I mean, reading through that, it was like, you know, with the, basically it was your 9 practices for not writing legacy code, essentially.
Yes.
Is a general summary of the James dumbed down version of the summary of the book. So, David, welcome to the show, and we'd love to kind of like pick your brain about how to help people understand how the technical practices do help us increase our agility.
Well, thank you. And it's so great to be back. Thanks for having me back. And I also want to just say, because we were at the speaker's dinner for this conference, and someone came up to me with a copy of my book and asked me to sign it. He said, I heard you on Agile Uprising like 3 years ago.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I just had to buy your book and read it. And it was so nice. It was like one of the most heartening things.
That's amazing.
So I'm really glad to be back.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you here.
Thank you.
We're happy to have you at the conference as well.
And I maybe set a little context. This is towards the end of the conference, so we're all a bit punchy.
Yes.
We might be goofing off a little
bit. Happy hour is looming.
Yes, indeed. But we can still have a great conversation.
Absolutely.
Okay, fire away.
Awesome. So, you know, kind of the book's come out. We're 3 years past the book. Like, what have you been kind of been doing? Like, have you been, you know, How's that kind of changed for you, and like maybe what you're talking about, what you're presenting about, what you're teaching organizations?
Yes. So my mission, as you know, is to help people on the technical side of Agile. And I really love that the Agile movement and the Scrum movement have exploded in recent years. But it is just the first step. I really want to share the message that, you know, once you have that doing some basic stuff with Agile and Scrum, the next step is to bring in the technical practices. If you're doing software development, because software development is a special thing, you know, it's unique unto itself and it's incredibly complex. And the way most developers were taught, both in schools and on the job, is sort of waterfall development, you know, where you kind of think it all through or try to think it all through in the beginning, and then you just sort of code to it. This is not how we do it in Agile. It turns out we need really different skills to be successful in doing iterative software development. So that's what I focus on. I teach teams how to do this stuff. And as you said, my book is also about that. My book is more about why the practices are important, because I find that there's a huge disconnect. not just in management and executives in terms of these technical practices, but even developers. So this is a book, and I don't know many other books that I could say this about, that you could give to developers to read, but also you can give to your executives to read. And it really helps get everyone on the same page with the practices. So what have I been doing in the last 3 years? Well, the book is really about why the practices are valuable. What I teach is how to actually do them for software developers. It's hardcore, intensive boot camp kind of development stuff. So I do like a 5-day intensive. And so I've been doing that for clients around the world, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. What do you find is there one thing that bubbles to the surface for developers of a practice that's hard to break or hard to adopt in what you teach?
I wouldn't say one thing.
Yeah.
Our
jobs would be easier if it was just one thing.
Actually, no. I think our jobs would be totally boring and
yeah.
We'd hate it. I've identified 30 things,
okay.
Which is what I teach in my classes.
Okay.
These are 30 principles and or practices in software development. And once we understand them, then we can get amazing results. So I want to point out that the list to be able to really master these and really do phenomenally well is minimal. It's a very finite list. And I've studied software developers. This is what I do. This is what my obsession is in life, is what makes great developers great is the question. And I've met developers who are 10 or even 100 times more productive than average developers. So my question to them is, what I try to research and understand is why? Why are they so good? And I find that everything that they do, practices, terminology, ways of thinking, all of these are learnable skills. So if we learn those skills, if we think the way they think, if we do what they do, we can get the same results. And
yeah.
I've proven this time and time again with teams.
I think there's a maybe a misconception or a belief in the Agile community that that these practices require developers to be more extroverted than they may like, spend more time interacting face-to-face with people than perhaps they may like. Mm. Do you find that those maybe soft skills or people skills are something that bubble up as an important trait in those developers that you've studied?
It's interesting, interesting. Well, first of all, I think we get a really bad rap as software developers. I've been told many times, oh, you're a bad communicator. I completely disagree. Now, I'm not great at making small talk at parties and talking about things that are, you know, kind of boring to me. But talking about this stuff, like my favorite stuff, is like, I love to talk about that stuff. And I think developers, because we have to communicate such complex concepts, we're awesome communicators. And that also becomes much clearer as we start collaborating and working together. One of the things that I'm really a big advocate of, since really our industry is full of beginners, our industry is the demand for software developers is like it's like the most hot job on the planet, right?
Yeah.
So according to Uncle Bob Martin, the industry doubles in programmers every 5 years and has for the last 20 or 30 years.
That's amazing.
Which means that the average level of experience on a team is 2.5 years. So we got a bunch of beginners running around trying to figure out what to do, right? So having somebody who is a little bit more experienced really can help the team really like nail that direction. It's really weird because here we are in an industry that really is the crux of everything, really. I mean, so many companies depend on software for everything. And yet we're sort of a hacky kind of business.
Yeah, fumbling our way through a lot of it.
It is. It feels that way sometimes, oftentimes.
Well, you know, Uncle Bob, you know, when he talked about that, it kind of made my head explode. I'm like thinking, well, yes, the tenure of people are like 2.5 years on a team. Like, but what do we, you know, what does that move? Like, what does the movement look like? It's almost, you know, you have professionals like electricians and plumbers that go through the whole like apprentice. There's the apprenticeship, and then you become a journeyman, and then you become a master.
Yes.
And you know, it's funny, like industry, like software development, like you have those developers that should be like, you know, they're at their peak of their performance, they're masters in their domain, but they don't want to work with the new guys. And it's like, how is this model completely broken yet?
Yeah.
Like electricians or plumbers, they seek out to get a new apprentice. They seek out to work with the journeyman and help them get to like that mastery level. So it's like, how do we start to bring some of those cultural aspects back into this market if the population is going to double every 5 years.
Yes. Yes. I love it because, I mean, we were having this conversation, but a lot of people are listening to it in the future. And that's so cool because I take it from somebody who has been a teacher for about 30 years and trained over 10,000 professional software developers. I can attest to this. The very best way to learn something is to teach it. And I believe that you really don't even know it until you are able to teach it. It's a whole different mental process, and it's an incredibly valuable one. So my mentor, Scott Bain, often says, always be mentoring and mentored. And that's the best advice I can give developers. Because as a community, we've figured out a lot of answers, and we just have to learn from each other. I'm a big believer in that this is the way we can solve this big challenge that we have, because software drives everything. And I really feel like this is the biggest financial loss in business, because it's not just what we're losing in terms of, you know, software, but all of the opportunities that every other industry is losing because we can't deliver good code, reliable code on a timely basis.
Yeah, and I guess that's I'm curious your thoughts on tactics like pairing or mob programming and how that helps further that mentor-mentee relationship inside of an organization.
Yes, yes. I'm a big believer in them. But I also find that people who are unfamiliar with these concepts completely misunderstand it. So, for example, pair programming. People think that it's taking turns at the computer, and that is not what pair programming is all about. It's about taking two minds to bear on a very challenging problem. And just like I can't move the big conference tables by myself from one room to another, I'd ask another person to help me. The same thing is true in very complex intellectual challenges that we face. It helps sometimes to have someone to knock ideas off of. And we can learn so much from each other. And when we do that, I think that it's a great, great step forward.
So I've had an amazing opportunity here local to Denver to do a 1 hour session on Agile for some of the dev bootcamp programs.
Ooh.
1 hour.
Uh-huh.
Out of a 9 month program.
Wow.
So I'm curious what you're seeing in the industry around, you know, these dev bootcamps that are spinning up and what they may be lacking and some of the practices that you think are critical to success in the software development industry.
I haven't really researched a lot of the dev bootcamps that are out there, but I know that like code camps I know about some of them in the Northwest, and that they're really bringing in a lot of people into the professional software development arena that are actually, what I find, is better equipped to deal with industry than people who go to like these fancy schools to get their computer science degrees. I think computer science degrees are at least 20 years behind the times. And there are a few notable exceptions. My friend Pat Reed runs one at, I think it's the University of California, Berkeley. And I know someone else who has one at Harvard. I know a few other people who have them at small community colleges that really get XP, and they're really doing amazing things. I have a friend, Thompson Morrison, who is doing this in grade schools, not for software development, but doing the Scrum processes and helping people take control of their own learning, which is all great. So I think that's really good. I think it's going to happen organically.
Yeah, I wish it was more than an hour, too.
I know. I had an hour for my talk this morning, and I'm like, oh, I want to share with you like how to do these practices, but I can't.
Yeah.
I can just tell you that they work.
Yep.
I've experienced them working. Excuse me.
It's funny. We had Brett on like an hour ago. Not even an hour ago. But he has a bunch of students here.
Yes.
That are doing Scrum in the classroom. So it's really cool to kind of get him in here. And you're right, Colleen. The boot camps are interesting. Now we have when I was working for a financial institution that supports one of these local coding kind of people that may have not had, you know, they didn't do well, like they weren't really school people, like, and so now they're interested in becoming a tester, getting into development, and they do put them through an intense program. And they bring them into various, they have industry mentors.
Oh, cool.
So, like, the program actually runs with people.
That's
like,
nice.
Software, like, one of the software engineers actually goes over to the camp and provides volunteer hours to say, like, here's how we do this, and here's some of the patterns we use, and, you know, here's some good practices on how to maintain the file system, and versioning, and if you write it like this, you can avoid merge conflicts and get mm-hmm. into some of the solid principles that, like, I kind of gloss over. Like, you start telling me about solid principles, and I'm like, oh, my God, I got to remember what they all are. But, I mean, there are people going in and teaching, at least at that program, some of those. So I think that That's they good. Are valuable. We also worked with a group of, you know, it was a consulting offering. And so instead of getting people to offshore, they did nearshoring.
Mm-hmm.
And they got basically, so when you bought this group of people to bring into your company, there were two senior engineers and then roughly 5 to 6 people that were just new. Like, they had basic software, they knew Java, they knew the basics of Java, some of the stuff. But they would be there literally coaching them on, like, here's how you could structure this, and here's the thought direction that you should be trying to write this in, and if you need me and get stuck, I will get you, you know, out of it. And so you would pay basically the same cost for India, but you would be getting 2 senior guys and a team.
Yeah.
And that team, you know, once you get the senior engineers in there and they start getting mixed in with everybody else, they quickly start to come up to speed.
Yes.
And then basically at the end of whatever contract they put you on, you could then buy them out.
Oh, interesting.
So you could buy the entry-level developers that literally just spent all this time building your software and learning it at a decent salary range.
It's like a developer lease.
It is a developer.
That's brilliant. It makes so much sense.
But then it's like, but then they hired people that they understood the skills. They saw them grow. They saw this work they were putting out. And then they can hire them. But it was way more cost effective than shipping it to India. And
yes.
You didn't have to deal with some of the language barriers and different things like that.
I'm starting to work with some consulting firms who do this. They write code, and then because I'm training their developers, they now can go into their clients and teach them these practices, have them do test-driven development and pairing and stuff. I think that's a big value add for them. So.
Absolutely. That's kind of Pivotal's model, right? Where they were doing a lot of pairing, I think, with all of their clients.
Yes, yes.
So that it was a mentor-mentee relationship, but from a consulting perspective, which is really interesting.
Yes. Well, since we're naming names, this is Slalom in Seattle, and they're doing it too. It's really nice.
You know, I think we didn't get a chance to interview Zach Boniker, who was also here at the conference,
yes.
but he did a great talk at the end of the day yesterday around hiring and retention, and he talked about this importance of making an investment in your employees when you look at the cost of turning, you know, the cost and rate, like you're mentioning, of how quickly developers are turning over. There is so much opportunity for developers. If you look at a LinkedIn feed of any developer you know, or check how many times they're getting pinged by recruiters for possible engagements, creating opportunities for them to learn and expand their skills, both as a mentor and a mentee, are super important to keeping them engaged and happy at where they're at.
Totally, totally. Software development is a very creative activity, and so we really want to engage their brains. And I think this is the real key to Agile, which is it's a lightweight approach because we want people to become present and think. It's not a checklist like CMMI or Waterfall. But I do see that a lot of people adopt Agile, quote, Agile, and they kind of treat it like Waterfall. We're doing this one, and we're doing that one, and we just did the stand-up. But doing the ceremonies without the intention of becoming present is really kind of not going to do us much good.
Yeah, absolutely. Along those same lines, and James, you talked about this in your talk this morning, I think one of the other things that is really near and dear to my heart is this concept of just-in-time development or just-in-time definition and bringing a problem to the team and letting them solve it, right? And that ties back exactly to what you're saying as well of you,
yes.
you hire a lot of brilliant minds, like let them group think and come up with brilliant solutions rather than spoon-feeding that to them. And I think we can get ourselves into some sticky situations when we try to spend too much of our energy from an Agile perspective in defining stories and creating a backlog that's 6 months out of fully defined implementation details and spoon feeding that to the team one piece at a time. And we strip away that opportunity for them to be creative and interact with each other in a problem solving capacity.
Yeah. So we want our product owners to really tell us what they want, but not how to do it.
Exactly.
Right. And we can then discover that's our job. That's what we're really good at is figuring out the implementation. And it's different, very different, to do it well than the way we normally think about things. You know, when a BA or a product owner says to me, okay, these are the things we need to do, and they list out like step by step. Well, that's procedural programming. But we like left that 30 years ago. And we're more in an object-oriented world where it's the interaction of objects that create the behavior we want. And the reason we do this is so that it's more extensible in the future. And that's really critical, because this is the thing that's really killing us in our industry, is we write code that's unchangeable. But when we write code that is changeable, then it's much more straightforward to work with in the future, and we don't wind up with big legacy code.
Well, so shifting gears a little bit here, I would love to hear your thoughts on the last 2 days of the conference, and were there any sessions that you attended that stood out to you in terms of things you can pull back into your teaching and coaching?
Let's see. So I've been on a whirlwind tour. I think I've done 5 conferences in the last 2 months. And that includes keynoting DevOps Days in Tokyo, speaking at Craft in Budapest, where there's over 2,000 software developers focused on software craftsmanship, speaking at Deliver Agile, which is the U.S. software craftsmanship movement, where there was only 200 people, speaking at the Scrum Alliance, the Scrum Gathering last week, and now here. So it's kind of a whirlwind, but... there was a really good session for me yesterday on technical practices for non-technical people.
I heard that was great.
I loved it. I thought it was brilliantly done, but there was a lot of non-technical people who were kind of glossing over a little bit. They didn't realize the value of what he was talking about. I think that was my favorite session.
That's awesome. How about you, James?
Yeah.
I went to one session, and then I fell asleep during it. And
were you in the front row?
I was sitting in the front row.
Oh,
was it
no.
about whip limits?
It might have been Colleen's talk.
Uh-oh.
She's a little bitter about that.
Understandably so.
I've seen it, though.
You have.
I've seen that talk. You started out strong, though.
From what you saw.
And you should have asked to borrow my clicker.
I know. Can you think of any other?
So there were a lot of different sessions that kind of went on. It's interesting to hear, like, if you look at this program here, it's been more, there was a boatload of Kanban. And like, it's interesting to see like pockets of like geography where things are hot.
Yeah.
And Denver seems to be pretty hot with Kanban right now.
I'm pretty happy about that.
But it's, you know, I stay agnostic. So I can see the value in both Kanban. I can see the value in Scrum. You know, I think that, you know, either one's valuable for your organization. But I do lean more towards flow.
That's good.
You know, but there is the level of enablement that needs to happen from teams and having the CI/CD pipelines and having an actual understanding of the value stream.
Good point. Yes.
And actually
yes.
being able to get from an idea to production. And so, you know, you promote the, you know, in a lot of your talks in the Kanban world focuses on, you know, not having inventory and not having that big backlog of stuff. But to make that smooth and make it fast, like, you need to understand the overall arch system. And then how do you modify that system?
I like to use the don't skip legs day meme of the bodybuilder with the huge arms, but then like the bird legs, where you've really optimized the shit out of one part of your system without regards for the other parts. And I think that fits to what you're saying of you can create a flow process for one part of your organization, and it's often development teams because they're expensive and we're trying to speed things up. But if you don't have the structures in place around those teams to enable that flow, it's going to stop there.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I have a Scrum Master on my team, and I have to give him credit because he was able to help the development team have a discussion about their deployment process and helped him kind of help, like, they did a value stream map of it, they talked through it, and he was like, they finally were able to see, like, oh, well, if we did X, Y, and Z, like a couple continuous improvement items, we could shave 5 hours out of the build and development process. And then we could check in like a couple times a day now instead of waiting 5 hours. And it's like, we don't have enough people looking at the system and going, hey, we're wasting a lot of time here.
Yeah.
And these were some technical things that Todd couldn't, Todd doesn't know how to do it, but he understood enough to facilitate the conversation. So it's important for technical, non-technical like development people to have at least a understanding of what teams are doing, so you can facilitate some of that conversation. So I think that talk is super relevant, and it would be more important. It's more important for people in our types of roles of coaches and scrum masters and things like that to start to learn some of these ways of bridging that gap.
Oh,
because
yes,
a lot of us aren't technical, and you know, I was a developer like 6 years ago. But, like, if you put me down in front of .NET now, and I'd be like, I don't know.
But, you know, no one is asking any manager, scrum master, product owner to do this. What we're asking is just understand why these things are valuable. You don't have to, you know, master this stuff. We're not asking you to go in and write code or anything like that. But just have some empathy for what the developers are going through. Because oftentimes life could be a lot easier for them. And that will translate into a lot better products for the company, you know?
Yeah.
And we were talking just a little bit about time boxing. And the way I think of it is everything is about transition. So we time box in order to scope box. So scope boxing is hard to teach, but you teach people to time box and they learn how to scope box. When we get good at scope boxing, we can let those training wheels of time boxing off and just do a flow, a Kanban flow is what I see.
It's a good way to look at it. And that is a method of just-in-time definition, right? By scoping a small amount of work rather than a big amount.
Yes, yes. And that's, I think, really kind of the first key in Agile. And it's something that, you know, the process stuff we've always talked about, which is make your tasks as small as possible. Because it gives you more opportunity for feedback. It gives you a better test when you write verification tests against that small behavior. Mm-hmm. So all those things are really good.
But it's, you know, it's really interesting because we talk about small tasks, we talk about writing, I can't get people convinced that they should write, TDD, I can't get people thinking about doing test-driven development. They're like, well, it's just as good to write the unit test after I've written the code, and mm-hmm, I'm like, but
It is very different, and you find that not only is it faster, but when you write the test after, you often find that you wrote untestable code, so you have to rewrite the code to make the test work and all that kind of stuff. The test is a really good target for what you want to actually build. So I find that, you know, the saying is ready, aim, fire. So we aim at the target before we actually do the thing. A lot of times developers will just jump in and start writing code randomly, and it's not always the best way to organize your work. I find that software development actually is like the most inefficient activity, and it's been shown, like research studies have shown that like it's like 80% of the things that software developers do is undoing irreversible decisions they made in the first 20% of their effort. This is an NIST study and it's very well documented. I gotta be honest with you, I'm considered a fairly smart guy. I cannot come up with a method of building software that is less efficient than the way we do it now. Now, fortunately, no one wants to pay you to figure out things less efficient. To me, I find all sorts of ways to improve efficiency. It just stares me at the face. And one of the things that is so valuable for developers with these practices is we, as developers, love to develop. That's what we do. We love to code. So most developers in their jobs don't spend very much time actually coding. 50, 40, 20, sometimes 20% of their effort is actually coding. Doing these practices of XP, test-first development and all this is coding. So we're spending less time in the debugger, we're spending less time reading and interpreting requirements and doing what we love to do, which is writing code. So when developers realize that, they get on board with XP immediately. They just need to be introduced to it well.
Maybe I'm not introducing it well enough, because I still get a lot of pushback.
It's been a few years. I think two or three years ago, we had Michael Feathers here as one of our keynotes.
Yes.
And I know, you know, I've been close to the planning exercises for Mile High for the last few years as well. And I know one of the things we always struggle with in building this conference and putting it on is how much technical content do you present in an Agile conference? And do we have developers in the audience that are coming here to learn those things, or are they coming here to learn more about Agile, you know, Agile and Scrum and Kanban? What do you see as content to bring that technical conversation into the Agile process and get developers excited about these practices?
This is interesting. On one hand, we need to, at conferences, with the Scrum Alliance, with Agile in general, we need to be more inclusive to software developers and create a message that it's not just about learning new languages and frameworks. It's about the artistic side, the creative side, which is involved in building more maintainable code. You know, we ask basically two questions in life all the time. What's different about these new things that I'm encountering from what I already know, or what's the same? Distinctions help us, you know, that's what they taught us in school for software development. But I find that the great developers really understand the other side, the right brain, the more creative, the more holistic side of understanding, seeing the similarities between things, and that helps them collapse the redundancy. It's also incredibly fun to do this because it is creative. I look at my code like poetry, and I read the code of some of my favorite people, and I weep because it's so beautiful, you know?
I love that.
Awesome.
Yes. So
I wrote, the only coding I've ever done was C++, and I don't feel like you would weep if you saw it.
He would weep if he saw it.
He would weep, but not for poetry.
You know, I look back at some of my old C++ code as well, and I'm like, oh my God. And then I look at some of my new code, like I just wrote an event handler in JavaScript, and it's very easy to do. It's so easy, like now, I mean, it's like, what, 4 or 5 lines more in Java. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to write those 5 lines of code. I want to do it in JavaScript instead. So, you know, we get used to the conveniences that we discover. That's humanity. And I think that's a good thing in humanity.
Yeah. Yep.
Super interesting. So, you know, the thing I struggle with is getting, you know, definitely getting engineers engaged. And
yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
even from a testing standpoint, like, and getting them to, you know, we try to get teams fully functioning. We're working to build T-shaped people. Mm-hmm. So we would like to specialize in generalist. But I think one of the things that I struggle with is breaking through to people to say, like, hey, this is valuable. Like, you know, I know that you're an amazing front-end developer, but, like, is it going to kill you to learn to write some Java? And like, how do you, like how would you, like, I'm always curious to see from like a developer standpoint, like how would you encourage people to want to have their specialty, but then branch out to like writing different stuff? Like, what would advice would you, like, I almost need this. Like, I,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I struggle with this all the time. And it's like, no, like we had people quit, like literally leave a company that I worked for, because they were being asked to be T-shaped people.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to do it. So, like, how can you bring some jazz around that to
That's
help?
That's a great question, James.
To help us broach this conversation.
I think that being a developer is kind of a specialty. It's like, it's not for everyone. And it is about constant learning. I know a lot of developers who have been in the field for 20 years, and they figured things out in the first 5 years of their career, and they just relive the fifth year of their career, another 15 years. You know, we're just doing the same thing over and over again. And this is not, I mean, yeah, there's going to be some of that in any industry, but I think the most successful developers are willing to constantly learn and grow. And that's quite important. This is one of the most fast-changing fields there is in any industry. I mean, if you don't want to, I was going to say, if you don't want to be in a fast-changing field, be an accountant, but even accountants are required to take a day of training every single year. And the thing is, and I've been at the top of the industry for a very long time, and I know that I know very little. And when I meet people who are like, I know everything, I'm like, you know, maybe you don't, maybe not. So humility, I think, is a very great characteristic of a master.
Yeah.
And it's challenging because, you know, we've achieved mastery in some fields, some aspects of our development, and now we're being asked to learn this whole new thing. Well, it's not going to take you years to learn it because you already have this experience. So it's going to take you a few weeks or a few months to learn, and then it's going to be another thing that you can use, another tool in your tool belt. Yeah. I find, again, though, one of the things that I know this for myself, I was totally burned out by the turn of the millennium at the year 2000, having been a developer for 15 years doing waterfall and doing the same thing over and over again. It's like, there's got to be something more. And there really is. There is this whole other side of software development that is extremely creative and phenomenally satisfying if you can get into it. That's what it's about.
Yeah, and I think what you're talking about with humility is so important too when we're trying to work with teams and coach developers in agile practices, is that we're not trying to say that you're not the expert, right?
Yeah.
You can still be an expert in your area of specialty on this team. But we're looking at ways to deliver together and to help each other learn and grow. And so that might mean sharing some of your expertise with somebody else.
Yes. Mentoring and be mentored and mentoring.
It's both.
It's good.
Absolutely.
It's very good.
I think that's the major lesson and learned and takeaway. Mentor and be mentored.
Yeah.
I mean, I think somewhere there was somebody wrote something about, we're learning it by helping or doing it and helping others. There's some document.
I think I remember that too.
Where was that? Where did I read that?
In
the bathroom on the stall.
It might have been. It might have been a bumper sticker. But it's funny. Like I think building and that was funny because we had Lynn Winterbore and Kristen.
Yep, Kristen McLemore.
On yesterday, towards the end of the day, and they were talking about coaching coaches and how they've kind of gone and found their mentor mentee kind of like, I'm a coach and I still need a coach.
Yes.
And how you find that and how you build those relationships. So at some level you are like, so there, it's amazing that there's two themes of, either coaching a coach or mentoring and being mentored all kind of come together as an idea.
Yeah. You learn so much from being a mentor and a mentee. Both.
Yes. And people ask me all the time, well, how do you learn all this stuff? Because you're always on the leading edge of technology. How do you know all this stuff? And I think there's two reasons for me. One is, first of all, there really are no new ideas under the sun. So these are just the old ideas repackaged in different ways. So when you can see the essence of it, it helps. But the other thing is, I am part of this amazing community. And I go to these conferences, and people like Llewellyn Falco and Arlo Belshi, as well as the many major published people, are there, and we can talk. I mean, I can sit down and talk to Ron Jeffries or... James Grinning. I mean, these are phenomenally brilliant people and very giving people. So I learn from the community a lot.
Absolutely. We're lucky that we have this community.
We're so fortunate.
We are.
We definitely had James on the show a couple times. Mm-hmm. He's been amazing to talk to. So
he's great.
David, we want to be, conscious of the time box and
yes.
your time and all the different activities that are probably getting ready to start ensuing since there's chips out. So would you like to, we'd like to give this opportunity to kind of let our listening audience know how they can get in touch with you. If they want to continue the conversation with you, anything you want to plug, and then we'll kind of close it out from there.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that opportunity, because this is what I do. I'm a consultant. So one of the reasons that I'm here talking to you and here at these nine conferences this year is to let people know that I'm available. So a lot of companies want to be excellent in software development and looking for someone like me. And it's very hard to find. There's only a handful of us in the world, really. To reach me, to get a hold of me, you can access me through my website, tobeagile.com, T-O-B-E, agile. Like, to be or not to be.
Absolutely.
And you can email me, and I'd love to talk with you if you have questions about the technical practices or... I also have this book, which is a great, I think there's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of consulting info in this little $38 book. So a lot of good stuff, and will also kind of help teams or managers help understand why these practices are worth their time and energy. It's called Beyond Legacy Code. It's available on Amazon or available from my publisher, Pragmatic Bookshelf.
Yep. We had Andy and Dave on recently to talk about the revamp of their book.
Oh, right on. Yes, what is it, their 20th anniversary?
It's the 20th anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah, so they revamped it. So, yeah, we've had Andy and Dave on the show, and it's awesome that there is a book publisher out there that publishes these kind of technical books.
Yes.
So, I've read through parts of it, and I need to pick it back up.
Well, thank you.
just steal it. I'll distract him. You steal Dave's book. So they can get it. So we do you Twitter?
Oh, yes, I do Twitter. I tweet, like, all the time about this stuff. And it's @2beagile.com. Oh, not sorry, it's late. 2beagile is my Twitter handle. I also have a blog, and I'm in my 10th anniversary of my blog. So you'll find hundreds upon hundreds of free blog posts about all this stuff. So if you're interested in that, you can look through it. And it's on my website, 2beagile.com.
Sweet.
Yeah. So I encourage people to learn more from everybody in the industry. And if I can help, please feel free to reach out to me.
Absolutely. Colleen, you got anything going on?
No.
Other than having a cute kid?
I am staying put in Denver. This is my big hurrah. So Mile High, and it's almost a wrap. And I will be home as much as possible.
Oh, good for you.
For the future. Yeah. Find me on Twitter, Scrum Hive.
We have all those bad choices of Twitter handles from back in the day.
Yeah.
So, the queen of Kanban with a scrum.
There's some irony there.
So, you know, and I got nothing going on. And you guys can find me at Scrumando on Twitter. It's where I'm most active. So, thanks again coming to you from Mile High. Really appreciate your time, David and Colleen.
Thank you for having
me. Super fun chat. And listeners, we thank you, and we're signing out.